In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Some years ago, I was the editor for a novel and wrote a screenplay based on it. Sadly, neither were able to break in. Maybe that timing just wasn't right. It was called Tribunal. It was about a group of doctors who get retribution for victims of horrendous crimes by using their medical skills to make the criminals experience the same kind of suffering that their victims experienced. Doctors unleashing horrors. Back then, I guess it was just too unbelievable. In one scene, one doctor is trying to convince another doctor that this is really happening. The doctor who refuses to believe it says the coroner didn't find anything. Autopsies can be fixed, says the other. Evidence mishandled. I read the toxicology reports myself, the defensive doctor says. They didn't indicate anything. But did you do the tests? There's silence as this sinks in. Tests can be manipulated to get the results you want, the other doctor says. Coroners don't always do the tests personally. He relies on lab technicians, findings from other doctors. Amazing, isn't it? So much of society depends on trust. Your whole system revolves around it. One lie, one deceitful puff from some lowly technician, and the entire house of cards collapses. A lot of today's show is about trust, and how our government and the institutions that support it, including the media and institutions of higher learning, have failed us. If anything, they've betrayed us, betrayed our trust. And something that gets lost in this, people have died as a result of their deceit, and they are continuing to die. There is a damning paper that was recently released, COVID-19, Restoring Public Trust During a Global Health Crisis. It details willful misconduct by public officials. Topics include the myth of asymptomatic transmission, which has been the foundation of all things COVID, PCR testing, effective treatments for COVID do exist, violations of federal law, inaccurate projection models, violation of medical ethics, and clinical trials continue while adverse events are multiplying each week. As many of you know, I was a researcher of trust for my dissertation. What I can tell you is that when there is a breach of trust, to regain it, you have to demonstrate you are working harder to repair trust than whatever it was that you did to break it. Right now, we're seeing none of that, which means those who broke trust have no interest in repairing it. Why is that? I'd like to welcome the author of that study, Dr. Henry Ely, to the show. He is the founder and executive community director of the Energetic Health Institute. He holds a doctorate in naturopathic medicine and is board certified in holistic nutrition. Dr. Ely, it's great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us today.
All right. Thanks for having me. It's fun to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So we wanted to have you on because of your paper and because of a terrific event that you were part of that was presented by the Organic Consumers Association, a COVID-19 tribunal exposing willful misconduct. And that was an absolutely fascinating roundtable. But let's start with getting to know you a bit better. For our audience, what is a doctor of naturopathy? And as a naturopath, how do you approach diseases and healthcare differently than an MD or a doctor of osteopathy?
All right. Well, first and foremost, the word doctor actually translates in Latin to using the word docere to teacher. So all doctors are really teachers. When we look at naturopathic versus allopathic, which is the conventional medical model, there's some stark contrasts. Although our intent is the same, to help make the lives of the people we serve better, the approaches are different. When we look at allopathic medicine, for example, their definition is the attempt to cure by replacing one morbid condition with another morbid condition. And that's directly from Tabor's medical dictionary. Now, that didn't sell too well because nobody likes morbid conditions, so they changed that to the word side effect, and that became a little more palatable for the public. Contrast that to a naturopathic doctor, and what we're designed to do is and taught to do is really to work with the body's innate healing mechanisms, the cells, and how the cells are designed to heal themselves by restoring homeostasis. So what we do is come in, our first rule is to do no harm, and with that to work with the body's innate healing power. So we use natural modalities, herbs, nutrition, lifestyle changes, nutrients, a lot of nutrient therapy in these days to help the body restore itself, you know, rather than force the body into a sense of some physiologic shift, as commonly happens with most pharmaceuticals and why there's so many side effects.
So how does that degree and approach to medicine, how does that make you uniquely qualified to speak on, say, COVID as a disease or on the lockdowns and restrictions that have come from it?
You know, I think that in and of itself doesn't make me qualified to speak on quote on COVID. I think it's the work of me and this awesome team of research professionals that do include allopathic doctors. I want to make the audience clear. Right. I'm not anti-allopathy by any stretch. If you get a broken arm, you want to go into the ER, you know. What I'm really about is what we're all in the pursuit of is the truth. And I work with some amazing people who volunteer their time and their expertise. Collectively, we've invested over 20,000 hours of investigation into this topic, the scientific literature, culling it, reviewing it, organizing it, so that we can share it with the public, because our intention is to provide empirical evidence in this situation and make sure that public health policy is based upon empirical scientific evidence and not because we said so. The biggest problem we're having right now, in my personal opinion, is that too much of what we're being told to do is because I said so. And to me, that sounds like, you know, a parental authority and not a governance, and not a governance that encourages collaboration.
Right, absolutely. So, setting aside the manipulation, the manipulated exploitation of COVID by health officials and politicians and big pharma, I'm personally convinced that America and the Western world is where it is today with this pandemic, in part because we can't be bothered to take a few vitamins in the morning, lose a little weight and get some exercise. I just believe that if we as a nation took better care of ourselves and built up our body's own defense systems, we just wouldn't be in this mess along with this societal panic that has come along with it. Am I wrong to think that way?
You, personally, I don't think you're wrong. It may come across to people that hear you say that as callous, as they want to misinterpret it. You know, everybody's reading into what everyone's saying. But if we're just stepping back for a second and being objective, it certainly bears that out. All the data bears that out. I mean, I was just reading through a document from Pfizer where they clearly know who the high-risk people are, people over 60, overweight, with comorbidities, particularly cardiovascular comorbidities, and particularly diabetes, which ultimately morphs into a cardiovascular pathology for far too many people. And it's a referendum, in my opinion, on a gross problem that has been brewing for decades in this country, is nutrient deficiencies and too much sedentary lifestyle practices. We were ripe for a virus or any kind of infectious disease to come in and really take hold of our most high at-risk populations. And we're seeing that bear out right now. So objectively, it makes sense. Take better care of yourselves. You know, we've been given this amazing gift of life and especially this amazing gift of our body. So for us, it's our responsibility as to care for that, you know, and I think what you're saying is spot on.
Yep. Okay, let's go and take a break there. Coming up, more with Dr. Henry Ely, author of a new paper discussing the willful misconduct by officials during the COVID response. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking today about COVID and in particular the government's and the healthcare industry's response to it, including some potential willful misconduct by our officials. We're talking with Dr. Henry Ely. He's the founder and executive community director of the Energetic Health Institute based right here in Portland. You can find out more about them by heading to energetichealthinstitute.org. Dr. Ely is the lead author on 5 research papers on COVID-19, including the most recent COVID-19, Restoring Public Trust During a Global Health Crisis, which details extensive acts of potential willful misconduct. We'll talk about that paper in the next segment. Before we get to your paper, though, let's start by looking at the reasons for your paper. At what point during this COVID pandemic did you just kind of sit up and think, that's not right, something's really dodgy?
On March 12th of 2020, we were following this. We had been anticipating this for a while. We had been looking at some of the vaccine manufacturers' prospectuses over the last several years, where they were alluding to a substantial leap in earning potential as a sell point for their shares. I've been following and been a big supporter of the medical freedom movement and personal choice movement when it comes to medical practice, you know, for coming up on almost a decade now. And, you know, we were really concerned that at some point there might be a major event or opportunity generated for something like this. So when we saw this go down with everything at the Wuhan Institute of Virology and following the event 201 at Johns Hopkins University last year, we felt like they were making a move, and we wanted to make sure we were in the thick of it from the beginning.
Hmm. For our audience, real quick, Medical Freedom Movement and Event 201, what are those?
Well, Medical Freedom Movement is the very simple idea that you have sovereignty over your body, that you have a right to decide what goes into and upon your body, and that you do not have to be beholden to any mandates. We feel very clearly that mandating anyone to do something that they are philosophically or faith-based against is wrong. It's un-American. Mm-hmm. And that every American should have the right to decide for themselves. And because we are the ones that have to live with the outcome of those decisions, whether that's it's right. In favor of use or in neglect in polite declination, I should say, of use. I will not have anyone tell me or my family what goes into or upon their body, not in this day and age.
That's right.
Period. Now, as far as Event 201 goes, Event 201 was a joint event held by Johns Hopkins University, the World Economic Forum, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. That was a training exercise to test out their software and their pandemic response work that they had been putting together for a few years. And it was very interesting that they then, when this started, employed Dr. Ferguson, who had been wrong egregiously with mad cow disease, and that they had been seeding the IHME group out of Washington University, that's somehow not really affiliated with Washington University, to the tune of $374 million over the previous few years. And the IHME group was the group that came up with all the projection models that the governors were using at the start to justify the lockdowns, that, hey, everybody, they basically were just saying, hey, everybody's going to die, so you better stay home. And they weren't based on any science, any empirical evidence. They were just guesses. And the guesses were egregiously wrong, but it didn't stop the shift in public health policy without any public or scientific comment.
You know, I remember seeing people discussing Event 201, and at the time I thought, boy, that just sounds an awful lot like conspiracy theory. And yet here we are. It's just amazing how that happened. So you've had the courage to question the mainstream media's narrative on the COVID pandemic and the response to it, including the lockdowns, which have been incredibly damaging on so many levels. What has it meant for you personally and professionally to take that stand against this raging hurricane of acceptable COVID narrative?
Well, I think personally, it's a very simple concept. You know, I want to live in the light, and I want to do what's right. You know, we have an obligation to our children to pass them on a world that's better than the one that we came into. That's my belief system. You know, so in putting together the COVID research team and working with all these incredible people that I'm so fortunate to work with, we have basically three rules: be kind, be accurate, and make sure that none of us come before the mission being to make sure that we preserve scientific integrity and freedom for all to decide what goes into and upon their bodies. I'm an ordained minister as well. And, you know, when you get the call to service, the only thing you can say, in my opinion, is yes, you know, and if that means I have to ask hard questions, then I have to ask hard questions. If that means I have to be relentless in my pursuit of truth, then I have to be relentless in my pursuit of truth. And if that means that I have to become unpopular in order to benefit children and grandchildren and people not yet born, then that's what I'm called to service to do. And that's what I will do.
That's really cool. That's really cool. So I know you have spoken out against the censoring of different viewpoints, and this is truly anti-science at a time when we're told to trust the science. It's not just the media and the government and social media all going all in to block any discussion. But there's a rabid censoring going on at the academic and science journal levels. A study just weeks ago from a Stanford professor that found no benefit to wearing a mask and over two dozen side effects from wearing them. The journal was pressured to retract it. An associate of yours, Dr. Mercola, he's been pressured to pull some of his articles. And the message here is clear. You do not question the official narrative. What do you make of this? And have you ever seen this before with any other disease?
What I make of it, Mark, is really simple. It's wrong. And we have to be able to stand firm and say when something is wrong, that it's wrong, and call those people out, because we've seen when we pressure people appropriately, and I'm not suggesting any violent means by any means, just standing up for what's right. When we call out what's wrong, they eventually and ultimately back down. So it's important for us to do that, because science can't become what a narrative wants it to be. Science has to be this altruistic pursuit of truth. Anytime I hear somebody say the science is settled, I get so upset, because that's not science. That's a narrative. And these are the same narratives that have sold us previously that it was okay for pregnant moms to smoke. It was okay for workers to play around in polyvinyl chloride and watch their bones demineralize in front of their face. It was okay to be sprayed with DDT and all these other lies that come out so that very few can profit off the injury of people who are otherwise wanting to be trusting. That is exploitation. It's wrong. And it's not something that I'm going to be able to ethically stand for. And if that means I have, again, to be unpopular, then so be it, you know. But we have to do what's right, especially in these times.
Absolutely.
And I think what's right is so key to being an American. And we have to make sure that our freedom of speech is never censored. And we have to make sure that scientific debate is encouraged, not suppressed.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's not just anti-science is censoring. It's anti-American for sure. All right, Dad, let's go and take a break. Coming up, we'll dig into his paper and some potential willful misconduct by public officials. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking today to Dr. Henry Ely. He's the founder and executive community director of the Energetic Health Institute, which is based right here in Portland. He holds a doctorate in naturopathic medicine and is board certified in holistic nutrition. He's also the lead author on five research papers on COVID-19. And we've been going through your paper here, the executive summary. I mean, this is the paper itself is 444 pages. You know, I've edited books far shorter than that, but it's pretty astonishing in terms of what you guys are uncovering here. But I couldn't even make it past the second sentence of that executive summary without getting steamed. You say, safe and effective treatments for COVID-19 are inexplicably being withheld. Why would they do that?
Well, that is the gazillion-dollar question, isn't it? You know, when we look around the world, we have insane number of studies that show the effectiveness of ivermectin, for example. Why it can't get approved in this country is beyond me. We've seen in every country when from the moment it gets improved, the fatality numbers drop dramatically. And the most recent being the Czech Republic. It's just astounding the rapidness of effectiveness in hospital situations and high risk situations with ivermectin. We've seen hydroxychloroquine and again, all of this is when used correctly. And there are protocols that have been developed. The American Association of Physicians and Surgeons has developed protocols on this. The frontline doctors have protocols on this that are safe and effective and clinically proven. And it's just astounding to me that we're not trusting our medical professionals on that side of the fence as we should be. Mm-hmm. When it comes to nutrition. One of my big things has been trying to get nutritional guidance issued here in the state of Oregon since I've been trying to work with the Oregon Health Authority since June 30th of 2020 to get guidance issued. They just will not work with me on this, which is stupefying because we have so much literature that shows empirical evidence that shows that vitamin D alone. When a person's blood levels are above 55 nanograms per milliliter, there is a 50% in reduction in infective spread. We see when we augment that with vitamin C, vitamin A, and zinc specifically, that the therapeutic index and the likelihood of infection drops dramatically. And when it drops, in accordance with that, what happens is when a person does get infected, the likelihood of recovery skyrockets because their body is already primed and prepped with the nutrients necessary to enter into natural adaptive immunity. Mm. So it lowers hospitalizations, it creates better outcomes for people who are hospitalized, and it reduces the likelihood of severe negative events like death. And long-haul syndrome. It's just absolutely stunning to me, Mark, because the CDC has known for over two decades that Americans, by and large, are deficient in key nutrients. Yeah. 65 to 95% of Americans are deficient in vitamin C, according to the CDC. Let me quote some other numbers in here, if I can for a second here. These blow me away that this is known. 35 to 45% of Americans are deficient in vitamin A. 37 to 46% of Americans are deficient in vitamin C, and 11 to 15% are deficient in zinc. And that's the minimum amount of these nutrients that is needed. So we Americans are grossly deficient in getting even the minimum of key nutrients. And if we can issue guidance for washing hands and staying 6 feet apart and wearing masks, washing hands actually has the most empirical evidence, and it's beyond debate at this point. But we have no substantial empirical evidence to support masking. We have no substantive of healthy people, and we have no substantial evidence at all to support distancing. But these have been employed by the public health officials instead of looking at the literature that exists at the CDC on gross nutrient deficiencies and empowering the people that they are sworn to serve to use the tools available to them and say, hey, we're not sure if this really is going to work, but it looks good. At least just say that and empower people to have a chance, you know, because if this is really about keeping hospitalizations low and positive outcomes and things like that, why are we withholding information that has empirical, substantial, global empirical evidence to support it?
Yep. The only reason you would do that is if you've got some other kind of agenda here afoot. So we'll talk more about Oregon in our final segment, so everyone needs to stick around for that. But I had mentioned the topics from your executive summary here in my opener, so let's dive into your paper here. Topic one, asymptomatic transmission. This is the basis practically for the entire reason for lockdowns and masking and social distancing. Talk to our audience about what the misconduct is here.
Well, there was a, first of all, they've never proven asymptomatic transmission based upon medical standards. Medical standards to prove asymptomatic transmission would be that we would have to, number one, prove that a person can be an asymptomatic carrier, meaning that they have the infection, but they're not mounting any immunological response. And that can be proven based upon the tools available under emergency use authorization, antibody testing, antigen testing, things of that nature. And then you would take a blood sample for somebody who tested positive with the virus in their bloodstream. You would take that and you'd put it in a petri dish and you would try to do a live cell culture of it. You know, so there's ways that we can do this to prove that a person can be an asymptomatic carrier. And then the next step is to prove that that asymptomatic carrier can pass it on to someone else. Instead, what was happened was a theory was thrown out of asymptomatic transmission without any empirical evidence. To this day, we do not have one case confirmed anywhere in the world of asymptomatic transmission. But we do have a study from Wuhan, Mark, that was very interesting.
Yes.
Wuhan studied almost 10 million people looking for asymptomatic transmission. Almost 10 million. And what they found using PCR analysis, antibody testing, and live cell culture in a petri dish, they found out of almost 10 million people, 300 possible candidates. When they went further and did additional testing on those 300 candidates, they found that exactly 0% of them were capable of transmitting the virus to anyone else. Then none of them were able to produce what Dr. Fauci has been teaching the American public on, what's called replication competent virus. They even contact traced 1,174 people that those folks had been in contact with and tested them for 2 weeks. Not one of them developed symptoms. So out of 10 million people tested very close to all the tenets of the scientific method. I mean, this was the best study that we've ever seen so far on asymptomatic. Not one person was an asymptomatic transmitter out of 10 million.
It's astounding that that has been the basis to shut everything down. Essentially, they're saying asymptomatic spread was the notion that we're all typhoid Marys. You have the disease, mm-hmm. you just don't know it. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty good way to spread fear. So, all right, let's go ahead and take a break. Coming up, we'll have more with Dr. Henry Ely talking about the willful misconduct his team uncovered in their paper. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Henry Ely. He's the founder and executive community director of the Energetic Health Institute based in Portland. And his team has put together a fantastic paper, COVID-19 Restoring Public Trust During a Global Health Crisis, that outlines some of the willful misconduct here by officials. And I'd like to jump ahead to topic number four to make sure we cover this. Violations of federal law perpetrated by the CDC itself. This is with respect to death certificates, irrevocably altering COVID-19 mortality metrics and causing unnecessary harm to the American public. Talk to our audience about what they did.
Well, on March 24th, 2020, the CDC put out a very curious COVID alert number 2 document. And when they put that out, one of the things that was a little shocking was that they said, if a person has a comorbidity, you can list it in part 2 of the death certificate. So the way it works traditionally, and for the last 17 years for death certificate reporting, is that part 1 will include all of the comorbidities. And the last line in part 1 is considered to be the cause of death. So essentially what happens is you have a situation where a person has chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, and hypertension, right? Maybe they've had that for about 10 years or so. What will happen is, and then they get sick in the hospital, maybe the flu, and then they die, right? Never before has somebody said, hey, we're going to call that a flu-related death. What would happen in part 1 of the death certificate is they would list the flu there, but it wouldn't be on the last line item. Hypertension or COPD would be, because the doctors and the medical examiners or the coroners understand that the flu didn't kill them. It was their pre-existing medical condition, their pre-existing state of health that really led to their unfortunate demise. So that change, it looked like a little small, subtle change, no big deal, right? Just a reminder for everybody. It actually is the biggest deal in the world, because it is the difference between a death certificate being listed correctly as the comorbidity or being listed, in my professional opinion, incorrectly as COVID-19, especially if there's no COVID-19 confirmation.
Right.
When we've talked with certified death reporting clerks about this, they agree. And what's been very interesting about this whole process is it's allowed the state health departments and the CDC to make the number of deaths related to COVID-19 appear much greater than we think they actually are. And it's one of the reasons
grossly
why we're
inflated.
Calling. Right, and exactly. And it's one of the reasons why we're calling for a full audit. We need to have a full, transparent audit of all death certificates to correct the count, because our personal and professional opinion is that the count is substantially inflated right now. And of course, that's very misleading and fraudulent to the public.
Do you have a sense of what the COVID deaths would actually look like if they had used the previous criteria?
Well, based upon what there were only surprisingly, let me back up a little bit. In early March, the CDC reported that the people most likely to be high risk were over 60 with comorbidities like diabetes and hypertension. We've known this. The data from Italy, my team looked and analyzed all the data from Italy early on last year. It supported this. It was very clear who the high risk group was, right? So when we started looking at this change in death certificate reporting, what we realized was that they're going to take all these people that really died due to their comorbidity, and they're going to call them COVID deaths. That's very concerning. So what the CDC says now is that 94% of all death certificates have, on average, 4.0 comorbidities.
Yes.
So
shocking. Shocking.
So now we're in this netherworld of, is this, did COVID do this, or did the comorbidity? And you have people arguing back and forth, and it's like, no, folks. We have a standard handbook that the CDC's published since 2003. Everybody's been using it for everything. So if you're going to change that standard for COVID, you have to change it for every infectious disease, or else there's no way for us to compare data. And that's what we've seen. The flu deaths are gone. They just vanished. Where did they go? They all became COVID deaths because of that change. So what they did essentially is they compromised the data integrity. And in doing so, they violated the Administrative Procedures Act, the Paperwork Reduction Act, and the Information Quality Act. And in doing that, that starts entering into, in our opinion, larger violations of federal codes that lead to the defrauding of the American public.
Yeah, you know, and what astonishes me about that, too, is the media is out there saying, oh, look, the flu just disappeared in 2020. Do you not have any critical thinking skills? It's just shocking. Mm-hmm. Topic two here in your executive summary, PCR testing. This is the major basis for the diagnosis of COVID in the first place. So what's going on with the PCR tests?
Well, first and foremost, the PCR tests are not calibrated to be able to diagnose whether or not a person's infectious. So it is absolutely the wrong tool to use to stop or slow the infective spread. And I think that's one of the big reasons why we've never been able to really get on top of this and kind of get things organized, because we're not using the right tool. When you look at a PCR is going to essentially make a bunch of photocopies. It's the best analogy I can give. And the more photocopies you make of this little sample of genetic material, the greater likelihood that there's going to be a false positive. So we've seen conclusively the work out of Oxford University that shows that when you get over 30 in terms of cycle threshold, the incidences of false positives exponentially skyrocket. And one of the things that's been very concerning for us is we've made records requests and submitted Freedom of Information Acts to get the actual cycle threshold values for every positive PCR test so that we can try to do some correction of these counts and see how many of these are likely false positive. And we've been denied those records requests. We can't get the information to do a proper scientific analysis of just how many people were likely infectious versus how many weren't. And what's very interesting about that, Mark, is if you today as a doctor are trying to send a sample to the CDC because you're concerned that a person who's been vaccinated has contracted the disease, so you want to confirm whether or not it's breakthrough, the CDC will not accept a sample over 28 cycle threshold.
Yes.
Because they know if they do so, it might be a false positive. But that hasn't changed their guidance on cycle threshold for the general public. The general public, the cycle threshold is still set at 40 for some inexplicable reason. So on one hand, they're inviting false positives into the case counts. But on the other hand, they're doing everything they can to limit false positives out of vaccine breakthrough.
Yeah. And of course, that's going to make it look like the vaccine's more effective than it is. So
correct.
All right. Let's go ahead and take a break. We'll have more with Dr. Henry Ely talking about his team's blockbuster expose of the potential willful misconduct in the COVID response. Stay with us. We're talking today with Dr. Henry Ely. He's the founder and executive community director of the Energetic Health Institute. And we've been talking about their paper that discusses the willful misconduct here by some of these officials. And we've already talked about topic three, effective COVID treatments for COVID exist, particularly vitamin D and some of the other vitamins. And we'll make sure that we link those up on iSpyRadio.com as well. So let's jump ahead to topic five, inaccurate projection models. These have been widely used to justify public health policies. They were way off in the beginning and, in my mind, done so purposefully in order to scare policymakers into taking unnecessary and unwarranted actions. Talk to us about these models and how they got it wrong.
You know, well, the first model that came out was out of the Imperial College of London by Dr. Ferguson, who, how he's still considered a doctor is beyond me with the number of inaccuracies, right? Yeah. But so that should have been the first clue that, hey, there's something amok right here, because, you know, there's nothing he won't do to lie, apparently. And I don't care if he hears this, you know. So that was the number one thing. He said 2.2 million Americans will die in this in the first year. And then immediately following that, the IHME group out of Washington University started publishing their data. Of course, they're backed by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and Microsoft to the tune of $384 million in two seed grant installments over the last few years. You know, and what was very interesting to me about that, Mark, was that the federal officials and state officials are not allowed to use projection models from other, you know, schools and things of that nature without public comment and scientific debate authorizing their use before. There are administrative procedures that have to go through before they can be used. But in this situation, everybody was in such a panic over this that they threw certain rules and certain laws out the window to grab these models. And what was very concerning when I was following last year very closely the IHME projection models was that they would be off by 150,000 to 200,000 fatalities in terms of their estimates. And then what they would do is by the time they would say that, you know, 100,000 people are going to die by this date this year, you know, and things like that. And then there would only be 50,000 people that had died. So then they would correct their model and to make it look like they got it right at the very end. You know what I mean? But they were wrong the entire time. And that's what they've been doing. And this is the problem with projection models. And I don't despise them, but and I understand their value in terms
The problem is by policymakers, they're taken as gospel truth.
Exactly.
Rather than for what they are. Exactly. They're projected. They're an educated guess, and yet they act as if it will in fact happen. Yeah.
And what became really concerning was when we saw their continued use after 2 months still into this. Because by 2 months in, we have all the data we need. Mm-hmm. You know, we can forecast and see how this is going. We know which populations are affected. We could really turn our attention to saying, hey, this hospital, we want you to do treatment A. Hey, this hospital, we want you to do treatment B. And within a month, we're going to see which one works better, and we'll even try to combine them. And we could get into the aggressive approach of treatment of this. But one of the things that Dr. Peter McCullough brought to my attention, which I was so shocked I hadn't even thought about, was that he said, look, you have to understand, people are getting a positive PCR test and told to go home and watch and wait. That's not medicine. That's certainly not compassionate care. Mm. What we do is we usually get to a definitive diagnosis so that we can initiate treatment to help prevent people from needing hospitalization. But that hasn't happened, and it's still not happening over a year later. That's in shocking. This country. It's shocking for us not to be able to do that. Issue some general sense of, hey, you got to go home, but these are the things that we know are going to be able to help you and prevent you from being hospitalized so that you can recover quickly. I mean, what are we doing?
I know. It is absolutely crazy. Real quick here, topic area six, violations of medical ethics appear to have been perpetuated by the CDC and FDA. And this is a big one. What gets me, as the executive summary points out, our government has a known history of lying to people and withholding viable treatments, such as with the Tuskegee syphilis experiments. And we're seeing it all over again. Talk to our audience about the violations here.
Well, in the Tuskegee experiment, there were 600 Americans entered into this study, right? Black men entered into this study, and they were done under false pretenses, number one. They were lied to and told they were just searching for bad blood. Okay, so number one, it was a lie. But that wasn't really the most egregious thing. What happened was in 1943, and I may be off on the year, but I believe it was 1943, the naval officials found penicillin to be a standout cure for syphilis. So instead of telling the men that were entered into this, who there were 399 men who had confirmed syphilis, instead of telling them that there was a definitive cure and they should have the option of getting that cure, they made a definitive decision of willful misconduct to withhold evidence-based treatments from these men for, I believe it was 29 years. It wasn't until a whistleblower came out from the CDC and actually gave the data to a journalist who published it that the country went into an outright uproar in 1972, and then that followed congressional hearings, and then the Belmont report comes out after it. But it was very clear that if there are evidence-based treatments that exist and you do not tell somebody in need, that is evidence of willful misconduct. And we feel that that's happening again, but not just to 399 Americans. We feel like it's happening to 332 million Americans.
Mm. Mm. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break a little bit early. We'll wrap things up with Dr. Henry Ely, including what's going on here in Oregon. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're on our final segment now with Dr. Henry Ely. He's the founder and executive community director of the Energetic Health Institute. He's also been part of a team that put together a fantastic paper, COVID-19, Restoring Public Trust During a Global Health Crisis. And just real quick, we need to wrap up there with topic 7 because I think it's so important right now. Clinical trials continue while adverse events are increasing each week that these experimental COVID biologics are distributed. So talk to us about this. What has been going on here with these vaccines?
First and foremost, everyone needs to understand that they are only emergency use authorized, and as such, they cannot be mandated even by a company, business, or anyone on an employee. It cannot happen because they're still in clinical trial. The Pfizer-BioNTech doesn't come out of clinical trial till April 6th of 2023. The Moderna, until which is in partnership with the National Institutes of Health, doesn't finish clinical trial till October 27th, 2020. And the Johnson & Johnson doesn't finish clinical trial until January 2nd, 2023. So these are going to be in clinical trial for a while, and they should be. The problem is that folks are pretty much being told that, you know, number one, they're effective, and number two, that they're being misled in many cases to state that they are FDA approved. I've seen a number of lawsuits challenging this, where the various state health departments have had to change their marketing approach to the public. What gets really concerning is when we start looking at the number of related deaths. And again, correlation doesn't equal causation, but these are big numbers. Typically, what happens is that when 5 people die from use of a product, it gets a black box warning, and when over 50, it gets recalled. So, as the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, which I want to make sure everybody understands, healthcare providers for COVID experimental vaccines are required to report all injuries and fatalities. They are required. This is the first time this has ever happened in the existence of the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System. It is not just people throwing out aberrant reports. These are medical professionals reporting to this system. And what's been reported through the 30th of April is 4,061 fatalities. In connection with the experimental COVID vaccines, which my team calls biologics because that's what the manufacturers call them as well.
Right.
When we look at this, there have been through April 30th, 159,432 reports of injuries. So we are way past, in terms of public safety, we are way past the marks at which point these should be recalled.
Yeah, shut down.
At least paused for a significant investigation of all of these issues. But we just seem to be plowing ahead. And what they're trying to inject into the public consciousness is the idea of acceptable casualty, which is a war philosophy, that you're going to have a certain number of casualties. Medicine does not accept that philosophy. Medicine is a do no harm philosophy. Yeah, we can't. So when, to me, it's alarming, and they say, well, it's out of 200 million doses that have been administered. I don't care. 4,061 people have died, and that's at least, that's the only what's been reported. And we have evidence-based treatments that exist. This is unconscionable for us to continue to press this forward, especially when there's no proof that
absolutely.
It is preventing the spread.
Absolutely. And yet we're seeing craziness happening right here in Oregon. Oregon State University just mandated that on-campus students have to have that. So let's talk a little bit about what's going on here in Oregon. You have not had a real good relationship with the Oregon Health Authority, as I understand it.
Well, I've done my best to be collaborative. I don't hold any ill will towards anyone. I think there are a lot of good people in that building, and I want to collaborate with them. And it's been very shocking to me that they are reluctant to collaborate with me. I've been trying to collaborate since June 30th with Dr. Dean Seidlinger. We've been in email communication. We've talked twice. We've participated in an expert forum in Yamhill County. He promised to meet with me to discuss a proposal that I've put together for issuing nutritional guidance to all Oregonians. And he promised that in February. I've been reaching out to him virtually every week since, and he won't get back to me now. And it's just, it's really disturbing.
Yeah, well, it is, especially on something so fundamental as nutrition. I mean, and if you can be helping, you know, when it comes to a pandemic, if this is the true pandemic, then it ought to be an all of the above approach, in my opinion. Also here in Oregon, we've seen data manipulation. Talk to us about the COVID hospital beds and what our governor has done on that.
Well, one of the things that was alarming was we did a research 2 weeks ago, or maybe it was a week ago. Time is really, really skewed. But when we looked at the number of beds that were slated for COVID-specific hospital beds, on December 14th, it was 1,489 beds were set aside for COVID patients. But by April 23rd, it had been reduced to 997. So that was a reduction of 492 beds. And what they're trying to say is that the driving factor in hospitalizations is COVID. That's not true. COVID hospitalizations make up a little over 7% of all hospitalizations in the state when you look at the OHA data. So it's not syncing up with the actual data. What they're saying isn't matching what the data is showing.
So real quick, we need to cover your paper's conclusion. You say the collection of this growing body of evidence demonstrates that an independent grand jury investigation and congressional investigation into the research discussed in our position paper is reasonable and necessary action on behalf of all Americans. How does that happen, and who would impanel that COVID grand jury?
You know, any grand jury can we've petitioned all grand juries and all U.S. attorneys with and empowered them with this information. Any of them can call for their own independent investigation into this. And we've been working with key congressional figures as well to empower them to say, hey, call for this congressional investigation. And whether that comes into reality, we'll see, and at what level, we'll see. But we feel it's a reasonable request under all of what we've unearthed.
Well, Dr. Ely, this has been fascinating. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
The call to action campaigns associated with this are making a difference. They've had over 50,000 letters sent to key members of Congress and getting meetings as a result, and 25,000 petition signatures. You know, it's natural to feel helpless at times like this, but the first step out of that is to do something. Taking a step is better than just standing still. And that step leads to more steps, more actions. Don't wait for the silver bullet to kill the monster. Beat it to death with 1,000 actions. There are a ton of links on this week's page at iSpyRadio.com, including how you can make your voice heard in less than a minute. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.